Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzschrauber. On today's show, something different. You've heard many an episode where a tech freedom person like Baron Soka rants and raves about the FCC. It's almost always a rant. But we're going to do something a little different today. We've heard from our listeners that they'd like to hear some more diverse viewpoints, people who approach telecom from a different standpoint than tech freedom. So I'm happy to say that I'm joined by Philip Barenbroek, Senior Counsel at Public Knowledge, a tech policy think tank. Philip, thanks for joining the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So people often see tech freedom and public knowledge as, you know, polar opposites on telecom. It doesn't always have to be that way, but that is certainly the perception. So this should certainly be an interesting show. But let's start off with the new FCC. We recently had an episode where Baron talked about Ajit Pai, Trump's pick for FCC chair, and what he's hoping to see out of the FCC. And obviously our listeners are very familiar with our thoughts on Pai, who's been on the show before, but Public Knowledge, which has not always seen eye to eye with Chairman Pai, to say the least. In general, what is your reaction so far?
So I think it's fair to say that we expected Chairman Pai to be named chairman of the FCC. We weren't sure whether it would be in a permanent capacity, which it is, or in an acting capacity. So we were sort of game planning for both scenarios. But now that news is official and he is the permanent chair, I think what we're hoping for is that Chairman Pai will embrace and put into practice some of the bipartisan language that he and Commissioner O'Reilly and really all of the FCC commissioners have, you know, for the last several years sort of bemoaned has gone by the wayside. You know, there's been a lot of, and I think anytime I attend a congressional hearing with FCC commissioners, you know, all the members of Congress and the members of the commission all sort of bemoan a better time when every vote was 5-0 and, you know, everyone sort of sang kumbaya and hung out in the hallways and we didn't need that silly sunshine rule. So, you know, I think, you know, we hope to see some of that bipartisan spirit, you know, with a commissioner, with a Chairman Pai FCC. I'm still getting used to saying Chairman Pai, as you can tell.
Yes, I'm also getting used to it. It's been, what, like 4 days?
Right, yeah. So we're hoping to see some of that bipartisan spirit and that the commission moves to take up, you know, consensus items before doing anything that's more more partisan or more polarizing.
Right.
You know, and I think there's a whole range of issues that we, you know, that I think there's a lot of bipartisan agreement on, from infrastructure issues to spectrum to, you know, sort of streamlining and rationalizing some of the operations of the agency. You know, I think there's a lot of widespread agreement on those issues. I think the disagreement in policy tends to be along the edges there and the details. You know, what we're hoping not to see is a move to basically immediately roll back the accomplishments of the Wheeler Obama era FCC.
So let's start with net neutrality, because the headlines are all very much proclaiming the death of net neutrality. I mean, if you just go on Google News and type in Pai, I mean, you'll see, and that's PAI, not PIE, even though he was named chairman, I think, on National Pi Day, which
I saw that.
Hilarious. Yeah. And not pie as in the number 3.14, but pie as in actual food. But anyway, so a lot of these headlines, net neutrality is dead, meet the man who's going to gut net neutrality, et cetera, et cetera. Is that the mood in your office? Or are you guys more optimistic about the future of net neutrality?
You know, I think it's a little bit to be determined. You know, I think we're optimistic long-term about the future of net neutrality. You know, we think that consumers and, you know, startup companies, small businesses all spoke with a relatively unanimous voice during the net neutrality proceeding in 2014, 2015, when we saw, you know, more than 4 million comments come into the FCC, overwhelmingly supporting net neutrality. I mean, I think there's disagreement around the edges about whether that meant Title II or some other approach on net neutrality.
Yeah, but at least 3 million to 1 million in general pro net neutrality to anti.
Right, exactly. And so I think there are several variables. You know, first and foremost, as a commissioner, Chairman Pai, you know, and I think we we'll see this play out in the Obamacare debate, the Obamacare repeal replace debate as well on the Hill. But it's relatively simple to oppose a policy and to strenuously object to it when you know that you're going to lose that policy fight. And you're fine being the second vote or the first vote of a 3-2 decision against you. It's entirely different to put together a coalition of three commissioners to approve a policy and to do something that that overturns a policy that is relatively recent and has been relatively recently upheld by the DC Circuit, but second, a policy that was, you know, not fudging, not dealing with the details of what consumers and what businesses put into the docket specifically, but a policy that consumers overwhelmingly tend to support, of net neutrality generally.
Right, and it's important that you point out generally, right, because the way that net neutrality got enacted is not the only way you can have net neutrality, right? So, and that's where a lot of this debate's going to be about, because if you listen to, you know, Chairman Walden, Republican on the House Energy and Commerce, you listen to Senator John Thune, who's the chairman in the Senate Commerce, they don't say they're against net neutrality. They say they're against Title II, which was the reclassification of broadband as a telecommunication service, which gave the FCC authority to regulate it. Now, there is some areas of bipartisan agreement on net neutrality, but all signs point to Chairman Pai opposing Title II as a legal authority over net neutrality. What is your organization, what do you think about the prospects for legislation? I mean, is Title II essentially a deal breaker on net neutrality, or are you open to the kinds of legislative deals that we saw get proposed last year by Upton and Thune, proposals that were floating around Congress even earlier than that? Maybe the 2010 rules that the FCC had enacted could be the basis of legislation. I mean, just given the prospects that Title II is on shaky ground, given that Pai has said very clearly he didn't support it, he dissented very fiercely from it, where do you see the legislative battle, and will public knowledge be making recommendations? Is there a bill you'd like to see? I know there's a lot there, so feel free to unpack it however you like.
Yeah, sure. So let me just start with Title II and the FCC space before we move over to Congress.
Right.
You know, I think I disagree with the idea that Title II is on shaky ground. You know, remember, right now you have a 2-1 FCC. I think, you know, with an issue that's this polarizing, at least the Title II piece of this issue, you wonder if Chairman Pai might say, it's better to have a full commission. It's better to have three Republicans, two Democrats, before we really begin to address net neutrality, which has been sort of the issue that's dominated the debate at the FCC for the last, I don't know, decade, let's say.
Yeah. I agree with that. It's been quite polarizing.
Yeah. So, you know, who knows? It may be possible that Chairman Pai says, look, it's better to have a fully filled commission before we move on that. That would probably be prudent, because then you wouldn't have claims from the other side saying, look, you know, you guys are ramming this through as quickly as possible. You don't even have a fully seated commission here, and you're sort of just doing this, full bore without a lot of consideration. I think it would be prudent for Chairman Pai to at least hold off on addressing net neutrality until he has a fully seated commission. Second, Title II was just upheld by the DC Circuit last June. That's when the decision came down, and we're still in the middle of the appeals process. I believe AT&T and U.S. Telecom have applied for an en banc hearing at the DC Circuit.
I think Tech Freedom joined as well.
Okay, yeah. So that's still in the works. That still hasn't been determined whether there will be that en banc hearing. AT&T has claimed in press reports that regardless of what happens with an en banc review, they will file for cert at the Supreme Court. So this could end up at a Supreme Court, you know, down the road. So we still have litigation ongoing on this issue. So Chairman Pai will have to make a decision. Do I want to step in the middle of this fight that's already being litigated potentially at the Supreme Court? So there's that issue as well. Lastly, getting to the fight between Title II and sort of the argument about whether Title II was the way to go, I think you have to I think there's been a little bit of disingenuousness around how Title II and the decision to take that route has been framed. Remember, back in 2010, the FCC adopted rules that prevented blocking and throttling and required transparency by ISPs. The 2014, the 2015 rules are a little bit different. They have a no paid prioritization rule, and they have the broader general conduct standard as well.
Right.
But that said, the FCC in 2010 didn't use Title II as its legal authority, and that was thrown out by the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit, and I think there's been some disagreement about how to interpret that Verizon decision from the D.C. Circuit back in 2014, but, you know, our reading of that case, and I think this is the reading that, that Chairman Wheeler and the majority on the FCC had in 2015, was that the court had said that the commission, unless it reclassifies broadband as a Title II service, doesn't have the authority to put in place a no-blocking rule or a no-throttling rule.
Right. And of course, our response to that, and that's a fair argument, our response to that has always been that the commission could have used this other legal authority, Section 706, which we also don't support as an independent grant of authority, but our view was that the court laid out two options for the FCC to take, Title II and 706. They chose Title II, and that's fair that, yes, they went back, and in order to get the rules on firmer legal ground, or firmer is not even a word, more firm, legal ground, they went the Title II route. And that's a fair argument because it was upheld by the D.C. Circuit.
Right.
But, of course, if Congress were to assert its role here, that would kind of moot this entire discussion over the legal details. And if, you know, I've seen a lot of quotes from public knowledge, and including on this show here, that Title II is not going to be as easy to undo as people say it is. You may be right politically, but if they wanted to, they could reinterpret broadband as a Title I service. They could just choose not to enforce it. I mean, there's a lot of tools the FCC can use at its disposal to just kind of not do Title II anymore.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, doesn't Trump getting elected prove the need for legislation, right? Isn't the fact that so many people in tech policy are freaking out over a Chairman Pai, that all of Wheeler's accomplishments are going to go away over just one election? And you mentioned some of these things are so recent. Doesn't that prove the need for Congress to step in so that communications policy doesn't just swing back and forth every 4 to 8 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to answer that question directly, that you know, legislation is necessary, because, you know, Congress has obviously delegated authority to the FCC to deal with these issues. That's the whole purpose of the Communications Act, to create an expert regulatory body to consider these questions, which tend to be more technical than Congress tends to want to get into. But, you know, moving on to the legislation, you know, you brought up the Walden, or sorry, the Thune-Upton bill from, I guess it was early 2014. This was the sort of legislative net neutrality effort, sort of right, you know, in the death throes of the net neutrality proceeding in early, what was it, early 2015.
Yeah, it was very much an attempt to avoid Title II, because Republicans were opposed to Title II. It didn't pass with any Republican votes, and no Republicans in Congress supported Title II, so they were trying to avoid Title II.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at that legislation in probably a year. So, but from what I remember it, and Gene Kimmelman, the president and CEO of Public Knowledge, testified on the bill. I believe it was in the House Energy and Commerce Committee, probably the C&T subcommittee. But you know, the position that we took on that legislation was that legislating net neutrality isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, we would support legislation that enshrines the principles of no blocking, no throttling, transparency, no paid prioritization. We would be supportive of having a conversation around legislation there. The question, though, and I think this is the big issue that legislation had with it that we pointed out, the legislation basically said to the FCC, the only authority you have over broadband has to do with those three practices. And I don't even think it included a paid prioritization element, or if it did, there was some language that made it relatively easy to circumvent.
Well, that's always been that. Yeah, that's always been a sticking point. I think those first three, no blocking, no malicious throttling, transparency, those have always been largely uncontroversial. I don't know many people who are critics of Tom Wheeler who don't support those three things. that would pass fairly easily in any Congress. I think this last one of note pay prioritization, that's always been a sticking point. The question being, are there any exceptions? Is it a bright line rule? Is it enforced on a case by case basis? And I'm not a lawyer, so I'll just put that important caveat. But I think, and it's been a while since I looked at the bill too, but if I remember correctly, it was a general presumption against, but you could get it. And the disagreement was folks at Public Knowledge said it was way too easy to get the exemption for paid prioritization, whereas folks who supported the bill said, no, this is a good balance because the agency can review these arrangements on a case-by-case basis and decide whether they harm consumers. So that's kind of a summary of where that legislation was.
Yeah, and I mean, the other issues that we had with that bill were, we mentioned Section 706 earlier. That bill would have gutted the FCC 706 authority, which, I think we tend to disagree on whether 706 authority is a good thing or a bad thing.
Or what it is. We would say it's mostly a mandate to deregulate and to help cities and states clear the way for private investment, whereas I think a lot of folks say that it is an independent grant of authority for the FCC to regulate communications.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the question is, what do you mean by deregulate? You know, I think if you frame deregulate as clearing the path for more competition and more deployment, but you only consider the barriers to competition and deployment as being state actions or actions by cities or actions by the federal government. If deregulating only means if promoting competition and deployment is only interpreted as removing government barriers, then I think we would disagree. But if promoting deployment and promoting competition also means addressing barriers that incumbents might put in the way of competing services to challenge them.
That's fair.
Yeah. So I think it's just, we're kind of talking semantics here, but it's sort of just how you interpret Section 706. Whereas I think the Thune-Upton bill would have eviscerated that Section 706 authority altogether. So there was that. And then the other issue was that, there are other issues in the broadband space, for instance, like privacy, which is a whole other complicated and controversial issue that the FCC has dealt with in the last few months, that the FCC would have been prohibited from dealing with for broadband services under that Thune-Upton bill. It would have said you can do for broadband services, you can regulate blocking and throttling, and you can mandate transparency, and that is it. Everything else is hands off. So things like quality of service, things like bill shock, things like spoofing, things like privacy, those would have all been off the table
for the FCC. It could be the Federal Trade Commission. And what are your thoughts on that? Because that's an interesting one. Because if Title II goes down, which we think it will, it's a matter of when, not if, and we can disagree about that. But let's assume that I'm right and that Title II goes down, which would then kick the issue of broadband regulation back to the FTC, including the privacy piece, which was an outgrowth of Title II. Once, for listeners who don't remember, once the FCC invoked Title II, it and turned broadband into a common carrier, that made the FTC does not have jurisdiction over common carriers. And there's still a court case out there that complicates this a little bit further. But in a world where the FTC regulates broadband and broadband privacy, what do you see as the problem there? Because I think there's a lot of folks on the right and maybe even Chairman Pai who think that some of these issues should be handled by the FTC as a general purpose technology regulator.
Sure. So, I mean, if you think about the Communications Act back in 1934, which was an outgrowth of the Radio Act that had preceded it. The 34 Communications Act established the Federal Communications Commission, which, its predecessor was the Federal Radio Commission. Its mission was to sort of oversee the public airwaves. Everything else has kind of grown out of that. The FCC, as being the communication services regulator, is a specific grant from Congress that says communications are important in this country. It's the way that Americans talk to one another. It's a way we entertain ourselves. It's with broadband now. It's a way that we engage with our government. It's a way that we access social services. We apply for jobs. It's sort of the lifeblood of the economy in many ways. Right. So the idea that you would have an industry-specific regulator to deal with competitive issues, to deal with competition issues, to promote more deployment of that service that I think we all agree is a good for society. I don't think that that's that controversial. I guess and you see this in other agencies too. For instance, we think that it's important that we have a safe and reliable food supply. So we have the USDA and the FDA regulating agriculture, but at the same time, the FTC would deal with unfair practices in the food industry. We see this dealing with pharmaceuticals. You have the FDA that oversees pharmaceuticals, but the FTC also has oversight as well. Banking as well. Think about, you have I don't know, some innumerable number of financial regulators, but you have the FTC sort of that can kind of apply a belt and suspenders approach as well. So, I think it's more controversial to say that the FTC should have the consumer protection and competition authority over communications networks, because that was never what was considered when we established the FCC. And throughout the FCC's tenure, we've always thought of the FCC as designing policies that promote the public interest and protect consumers and promote competition. That is the mission of the agency. And if you were to strip away the consumer protection and competition components of the agency and hand it over to the FTC, what are you really left with? You're left with sort of licensing, and I don't know what else.
I think there's a lot of people who want that to happen, that they say that the FTC's approach is better than the FCC because it's mostly focused on enforcement and consumer protection, not on rulemaking, and it's policing bad behavior after the fact, not before the fact. And there's a lot of people who say, including Tech Freedom, that in this world where technology silos are constantly being torn down, where content owners are both edge companies like Google and Facebook, but also Amazon, which started out as a bookstore, and Hulu owns content, and Comcast owns content, and AT&T owns content, and there's vertical integration going on, that having a silo-specific regulator, right? So the FCC says, this is broadband, we regulate it this way, this is radio, we regulate it this way, that doesn't make sense anymore, that these walls are being torn down. Feel free to respond to that, but then I also want to move on to common ground and broadband deployment.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think some of those walls are being torn down. Like, for instance, you've seen Google enter the network market, with Google Fiber service or Google Fi, the wireless service.
I am a subscriber.
And then you've seen network companies like Comcast, for instance, acquire content, or Verizon acquire digital content like AOL or Yahoo. There is some tearing down of those silos, but at the end of the day, you still have relatively few companies that control the vast majority of network connections. And remember, you cannot access any of that edge content that I think we all want to get at without really going through AT&T or Verizon or Comcast or Charter. Those are sort of the four large behemoth companies that dominate the communications marketplace, and they really control access to all of that edge content. So no matter how much content they've acquired, and no matter how much content these other companies like Amazon or Google or Netflix acquire, you still, to simply get online, most Americans are dealing with a very large monopoly or duopoly company in their individual market.
So let's address that, because everyone agrees that having more options, better speed, faster service is a good thing. And we would actually say that if you had all those things and people had favorable views of their broadband companies, which they obviously don't, then we wouldn't be having a discussion about Title II. That I think one of the reasons that those 3 million people submitted comments is because they're pissed off with the situation they're in, and that's understandable. And there's a lot of talk right now about infrastructure. President Trump wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. We'll see what some of the spending hawks in the Republican Party have to say about that. But we could agree that while our assessment of the broadband landscape is probably a lot less bleak than Chairman Wheeler and public knowledge, we all want to see more Google Fibers. Let 1,000 Google Fibers bloom, right? Let's have more competition, better speed, faster service. So how do we get there? And Chairman Wheeler's FCC focused a lot on fiber to the home as a solution, even in some areas. You're right earlier that you said it's not just state regulation that prevents broadband deployment. Basic economics prevents broadband deployment. There are people in rural areas in this country where a private provider can look at it all they want and crunch the numbers a million times, and it just doesn't make sense for them to spend that money because there's not enough demand, or it's just the economics don't make sense. So absolutely fair, and we should be exploring potentially public-private partnerships. So what are your priorities in an infrastructure bill? I mean, there's spectrum needs to be freed up. We're talking about 5G, you know, millions of small cells all over the United States. Is your organization thinking about what you would like to see in a broadband infrastructure bill? Or sorry, an infrastructure bill that has a broadband component?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the spectrum side, you know, which you mentioned, I think spectrum's an issue where there's a lot of bipartisan agreement. And I think a lot of consensus has been driven by conversations that have, you know, been convened by Chairman Thune and you know, Chairman Nelson or Ranking Member Nelson, Senator Schatz, Senator Wicker on the Senate Commerce Committee. And you've had Mobile Now, which is a, I guess it's SR9 is the bill number this year. It passed out of committee last year. It was held up on the floor of the Senate.
Over politics, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were a whole bunch of intermingled communications issues we don't have to get into. But
we could agree that it wasn't the substance of the bill that held it up. It was political battles over confirmations and renominations and things like that. So
right.
The bill did not fail because people didn't like the bill.
Right, yes. Yeah. It passed out of committee unanimously last year. And then on Tuesday, on I guess it was January 24th, it passed out of committee unanimously again. So I would expect to see that bill, pass out of the Senate. And I, you know, it wouldn't shock me to see, the House tweak it a little bit, but it wouldn't shock me to also to see that bill pass out of the House and end up being law, which, you know, that bill basically enshrines into law the goal of President Obama to free up 500, megahertz spectrum for, commercial and unlicensed use by 2020. It sets up you know, some amount of spectrum that needs to be set aside for unlicensed, some amount for commercial licensed, and it directs the FCC and the NTIA to look at several different bands and to figure out how to repurpose spectrum that's held by federal users, and to figure out how to make those users use spectrum more efficiently and move the surplus into the private sector. So that's all well and good, and I think that's an important step on spectrum policy. On infrastructure, you know, I think there's probably going to be disagreement over what exactly should be done. I think at public knowledge, I think our point of view is that the private sector has largely, and you referenced this earlier with some of the economics of just building out to rural communities. The private sector has largely said it's incredibly tough to justify building out to rural America. And so the key, if we're taking sort of the lessons from the election, that there are lots of areas of America that feel like they've been left behind and yep. justifiably so, and we need to bring economic opportunity to those areas. It's more than just finding construction jobs to build roads and bridges for those people.
Or promises to bring back jobs that a lot of economists say are just not coming back.
Right.
Globalization has effects, and to, you know, dreaming of the old auto factory coming back might not be a solution, but broadband could be a helpful thing.
It could be. And the thing is, you know, for all the worker retraining that people have talked about, you know, since I've been aware politically, if you go back to like the 90s when you talked about NAFTA, it was, these people will get retrained for the jobs of the future. Well, the jobs of the future today require a broadband connection and they require digital literacy. And so if you have communities that aren't connected, there's no way for those communities to thrive and to sort of rebound in the digital economy we have today. So connecting those communities has got to be part of a broadband infrastructure plan if we're going to really make America great for those communities going forward, to steal a turn of phrase from the president.
Yes. So our approach, and I just want to get your thoughts on our approach, because we're thinking that this is exactly the same thing, right? This is an area of bipartisan agreement. We all, at least, there were so many things said about the election result, but one thing that everyone agrees is that there's clearly a population that feels left behind, and you saw that in Brexit, and you're seeing it all over the world with these populist revolts against globalization. So how do we get more broadband out there? We would like to see an approach that is kind of an exhaustion approach, right? So start out with the most basic thing. Purely libertarian things like cutting red tape, simplifying deployment. There are things that local governments do that are just very counterproductive. And sometimes that's in concert with incumbents. Sometimes it's the unhealthy alliance between corporations and government. Right. Sometimes it's just government. Sometimes it's just the company. But there's red tape in the way. Simplify that. Step one. Step two, that's often not enough. There's expensive deployment. You know, as you say, the economics don't make sense. What are the natural monopolies here? Streets. Sometimes the poles. Sometimes it's highways. Every time those things are dug up, broadband conduit should be put in that could be leased to any private provider. That's a no-brainer. Everyone's in favor of dig ones. Sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes the government might need to build dark fiber, which could then be used by a private company. But at Tech Freedom, a big thing for us is government-run broadband should be a last resort. We don't think that cities should be going around building broadband networks to compete with the private sector in an effort to make money for the city or as the solution to competition woes when these other things haven't been tried yet. But if you try those first three things, cut the red tape, try dig once, try dark fiber, public-private partnerships, all of that fails, and we're talking about the rarest of circumstances, a glacier town or a Native American reservation, then it might make sense for the city to step in and build the network because there's no other option. But we criticize Chairman Wheeler for focusing on muni broadband, municipal broadband, as a kind of like a first solution, not a last solution. And President Obama in that way, and public knowledge seems to have been very supportive of those efforts, given that the Sixth Circuit ruled that the FCC cannot preempt state laws on broadband and that a lot of states are run by Republicans now and government-run broadband is probably not going to be a big focus for these Republican states. Maybe it will. Would you agree with an exhaustion approach, or how are you approaching this issue?
Well, I think I disagree with your classification or your characterization of sort of the order of priority that Chairman Wheeler put on muni broadband. But generally, we do agree with an exhaustion approach. We agree. We think in order to connect communities, whether it's urban areas that have been unserved by the incumbents that are nearby, or suburban towns that just are simply passed by, or whether it's rural areas, and all of the above approach is the way to go about this. If there are direct government subsidy programs, companies should take advantage of those programs. Those subsidies should be set up in a way that tries to promote competition and affordability of service. I think one of the issues that we haven't gotten into, we agree on deployment being critical and important, but once broadband gets to a community, it's also important that broadband be affordable for the people in that community. If the average income of a community is $20,000, but it's going to cost them, $1,500 a year to subscribe to broadband, that probably isn't going to work for those people. Right. Even if there's a service, if it's not affordable, it's not really accessible. I think making sure that broadband is deployed, we should be taking an all of the above approach. But we also need to make sure it's affordable. But just getting to the muni broadband piece quickly, I think what governors and mayors have to deal with, which is a little bit different than I think folks in Congress or even state legislatures have to deal with, is they're responsible for making the trains run on time. They're responsible for making sure that the communities that they represent have opportunity, that people don't feel helpless. And so I think in towns and cities where people have decided to go the muni broadband route, what they've largely said is they've gone to the local cable company and they've gone to the phone company that's nearby and they've asked those companies, come in here and build. We'll subsidize you and we'll make this great for you and we'll make sure that you can turn a profit. And the company in some cases has just largely said we're not interested. Like the cost benefit doesn't work out for us. And in those instances, you've seen communities build muni broadband. I think the jury's out on whether it's necessarily the best outcome for every community. But communities that feel passed by shouldn't be prevented from self-serving. And I hope there's some agreement on that. I think, you know, the sort of small the small C conservative idea that people should be able to self-govern and make choices at the local level. I think that's true in sort of the muni broadband movement. And I don't want that to be lost. I think that should be sort of a core universal value. And I know that there's a lot of disagreement over muni broadband, and it's been a contentious issue. But it shouldn't be. It should be deployment in rural areas should be an all of the above strategy. And we can disagree on what the priorities should be. But I think you mentioned a lot of excellent prescriptions in cutting red tape, increasing dark fiber, dig once. Those are all core policy prescriptions that public knowledge has been supportive of. Right. I think there's a lot of agreement there. I think just sort of the order of priorities and some of the characterization issues. But I think everybody in this space on muni broadband has engaged in sort of character assassination on one level or another over the last several years. But I think if we can sort of all, put down our weapons and back away, I think there's, sort of an opportunity to really do right by those communities that need it.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it might have been a fantasy world when those congressmen were talking about the good old days of bipartisanship. But to the extent that that was real, let's try to get back there. And telecom really should not be as partisan as it is. Let's hope that going forward, despite disagreements over Chairman Pai and his agenda, that we can find this common ground. And with some of the more partisan things like net neutrality potentially getting resolved, hopefully in a more permanent way, there is so much agreement on broadband deployment, and there's so much agreement on spectrum and the government giving up spectrum that it's not using so that the private sector can use it, and a lot of good ideas. And everyone can get behind dig once. A lot of people can get behind dig dark fiber. So looking forward to it, and I'm hoping that while our organizations are often seen as hopelessly at odds, that it doesn't have to be that way. And I appreciate you coming over to enemy territory to record this podcast with me. My guest has been Philip Barenbroek, Senior Counsel at Public Knowledge, a tech policy think tank, which will hopefully be closer to tech freedom than it has been in the past. Philip, thanks so much for joining.
All right, thanks.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Feel free to pitch yourself as a guest or a friend. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.